Happy New Year and welcome back to the Downtown Den Politics podcast. We are only 3 weeks into 2024. There is already a huge amount of political news, some of which we'll be discussing this week. This year, we'll see over 50 national elections take place across the globe, including polls for the European Parliament, the American presidential election, and a general election in the UK, of course, plus some very important mayoral contests. We've seen the post office scandal unravel on the back of a tremendous ITV drama, I have to say. Troubles in the Middle East have escalated, and we're only, as I say, 3 weeks into our new year. But this week, with my co-host Jim Hancock, I'll be reflecting on another turbulent week for the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. We'll also consider some mixed opinion polls which have been published this week, and I'll be asking if Donald Trump's return to the White House is now inevitable. Welcome back to the new season of the Downtown Den Politics podcast.
Just a bigoted woman.
Me and my friends sort of used to run through the fields of wheat.
You turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
It will cost.
I know words, I have the best words, but there's no better word than stupid.
Well, James, welcome back to the Downtown Den and our political podcast. Did you have a good Christmas?
Yes, I did. Yes. Grandchildren dressing up as Santa Claus, with my granddaughter pretending to be Rudolph and me holding her with a tinsel rein. The video of this is available, actually.
Well, we'll have to get that on the YouTube channel and let people watch it. So, as I've mentioned, there's already been an awful lot of things happening in the world of politics. It seems as though, you know, they say a week's a long time in politics, but it certainly is at this moment in time. And we're not going to focus too much on this, but of course, I did mention in my introduction the post office scandal, and you blogged about this in the Downtown Bulletin last week. And it's incredible, isn't it, that it takes a television drama to give it the focus that really it ought to have been given many years ago by our politicians.
Yes, I mean, I just felt, you know, they're having been very dilatory about it. The two things happened. One was a sort of political pile-in against Ed Davey. Now, I don't think he's doing a particularly good job. I don't think he's a highly impressive politician. I think he's a man of integrity. But there have been about 10 post-ministers over the years. And so that sort of unedifying attempt to try and make politics out of it, I don't think will have gone down well with these poor postmasters and postmistresses. That's not what they want. And then this sudden action by the government, you know, which, you know, so often when anybody wants anything done, there's, oh, no parliamentary time, you know, oh, I'd love to do something, but there's no parliamentary time. There's always parliamentary time if people want to do it. But the final thing I'd say on this is the payouts. It's still far from clear to me how this is going to be done. There are a lot of questions about it. Apparently, the document these people have to fill in is about 14 pages long and is highly complex, and a leading lawyer, I'm trying to think of his name now, he's often referred to, said, you know, even I, as a trained Inland Revenue lawyer, find it difficult to understand it. So let's see when these full payments are made. Let's see when Fujitsu actually make their contribution, what proportion of the contribution, that so that you and I aren't going to have to pay this. Because, you know, there's all this compensation. It's our money, Frank. It's not correct. Even coming out of the post office profits, which apparently, when they said, you know, they were making money, well, the money went back into the post office accounts and presumably then went into the dividends that were paid to the directors. So,
Absolutely scandalous. I mean, the trouble with these things is, you know, life is so fast moving these days that in 6 months' time, is the same sort of pressure going to be on the politicians to do something about the issue? And it still won't have been resolved for those people. So you can only hope that there is a resolution found quickly, a satisfactory resolution. But, you know, sadly, an awful lot of those people who were affected have now either died or, you know, tragically, some of them even committed suicide.
And you can't call your life back, can you? They've been
22 years. And one of the
really
cases has been
some
going
of these,
on.
The families of some of these people disowned them, believing that they were criminals. You know, so all that, those wounds can never be restored. No. The damage can money is never going to compensate them. But, you know, we just need to try and learn the lessons from this and learn that all this computer technology, which is wonderful, and we've got AI coming along, we're going to have to be very, very vigilant to make sure that from the huge advances we're making in technology, things don't happen that really bear down on individual people's lives.
I fear, though, that we're not looking at something that is particularly unique to the post office, because, I mean, my experience with HMRC, never mind people who are in real trouble with the revenue, absolutely scandalous. I mean, some of the letters they sent, which is obviously, you know, just churning out computer generated stuff. But if you was an individual with a particular mental disposition, it could send you over the edge. And again, I'm reading this morning the news that somebody's committed suicide on the back of being pestered by the Inland Revenue, maybe or maybe not, money they owe. And then you've got, you know, the likes of city councils here with business rates sending strong arm people round to get money back off businesses, and they can't tell you whether the money's owed or it isn't, because such is the state of the bureaucracy within Liverpool City Council. I'm sure Liverpool's not on its own as far as that's concerned. There's an awful lot of these cases that, you know, match what's been going on at the post office. And are we going to have to wait another 20 years or see people committing suicide for action to be taken on them?
I mean, just in my own family finances, we're trying to contact the HMRC over a fairly trivial amount of money that they owe us. You cannot get hold of them in any way at all. They will not respond. They keep sending out next year's demands, but you try and contact them by letter or by hanging on the phone. You cannot get hold of them. We've got a very, very trivial complaint. I just wonder, as you say, with people with bigger issues, you know, what is going on? Are they working from home? Are they not? Are they just going to?
No, they're at home. The problem is they're not working. And again, you know, this is the problem, isn't it? You know, I'm sorry, but there's an awful lot of people who would be classed as civil servants who are working from home. And I don't think that the productivity level is anywhere near pre-COVID levels. And the service that we get now as taxpayers is absolutely atrocious. And, you can look at most town halls in this country. You can certainly look at government departments. And I'm sorry, because you'll have trade unions now jumping up and down saying our members deserve to be able to work from home. Well, why? It wasn't the case pre-pandemic. Why is it now? And if the service provision has fallen so badly, and it certainly has, I don't know anybody who's having good experiences with local authorities, good experiences with HMRC or any other government department for that matter. And I'm sorry, but as I say, I think the work from home thing has got an awful lot
to
do with
it. This is an explosive issue. There was an article in the paper, and there was a discussion on the Today programme just yesterday about the productivity levels of the private sector and the public sector over the last 40 or 50 years. And it's absolutely devastating. It's like 60% improvement in the private sector, and the public sector has been virtually level. Now, the TUC person, I don't want to, you know, pile on to the civil servants who do a great job and all this sort of stuff. But she was saying, well, you know, it's very people focused, the public sector, it's under resourced, we're working with out of date equipment. So that has to be put into the scale. But it is an interesting challenge if Sir Keir Starmer comes to power, because there is a perception that Labour's a bit soft on the public sector. You know, who's going to get to grips with this productivity issue? You know, because those are the facts. In the private sector, with the drive of, as you know, Frank, you know, downtown either makes money or it goes out of business. Those are the pressures on the private sector, which are not apparent in the public sector.
No, it's a big issue. And I think it's one that is going to emerge over the next 12 months, actually, because I think, again, on the back of that drama, people are now going to be more likely to speak up and say, well, me too. It might be with a different organisation, but actually we're getting the same sort of pressure. Just very quickly before we move on to the main body of the programme this week, which, as I say, is going to be Sunak, Labour's performance in the polls, and then the presidential election. But the Ed Davey thing that you mentioned, now I am absolutely with you in terms of saying that he shouldn't be resigning because of an issue that many, many ministers let slip or didn't appreciate the seriousness of, or actually, as he said, just blatantly lied to. I think Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson were lied to back in the day, or certainly convinced to continue with the Horizon scheme, which was flawed, but they were already in for a certain amount of money, and I think Blair was convinced to just continue to throw more money at it. So I don't think he should resign on the basis of his performance as a minister. What I was disappointed by was his interview, where for some bizarre reason, he just refused to say that very simple word, sorry. And I have absolutely nothing to do with anything regarding the post office scandal. I watched that television drama and I was sorry. Why couldn't he say sorry, Jim?
There seems to be a thing about this, the question of apologizing and saying sorry. He probably should have, he could have said, yeah, I'm sorry for my role in it, but it sounds like my media training. Then you bridge to what you want to say. I am sorry, genuinely sorry.
That's all he had to say.
I was only one of many people who were, it would have relieved the tension. I think
whoever's advising him should be sacked, because it was the simplest thing. Even as you mentioned, the post office people who were impacted by that terrible experience said afterwards they didn't want to see ministers, former ministers, resign. That was not part of the agenda. But equally, I heard a number of them after that Ed Davey interview saying, well, not really impressed with that. I really do think he let himself down badly. I don't think he's the most charismatic of leaders, but then neither is Keir Starmer, neither is Rishi
Sunak.
And
he's now gone in a position which is really unfortunate, because I heard it yesterday, the World at One saying, we've repeatedly asked Ed Davey to do an interview, but he's not available. So
he's in a bit of trouble, I think. Could be in a bit of trouble. I don't know whether that. Listen, I don't follow the Lib Dem politics particularly closely, as you know. But have they got an alternative?
No, that's what I think keeps him. If there was a charismatic, possibly not now, it's too close to the election, but if there had been over the last few years somebody rising up who was, as I've said many times before on this podcast, the Liberal Democrats to stand a chance need a Charles Kennedy or Paddy Ashton. They can't cut through with a nice guy but low key. That only goes so far. It might win them some seats in the blue wall. We'll probably come on to discuss it. But I just think there isn't anybody else.
Yeah. So Ed Davey, a bit fortunate. Reminds me of Jeremy Thorpe, but we won't go there. Anyway, Jim, let's get on, as I say, to the main body of the programme this week. And Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who I think would have come into the new year thinking, okay, the economy is going to improve a little. Inflation had come down. Of course, we've had figures this week not as positive. I'm going to stop the boats again. Immigration numbers, boat crossings have reduced somewhat, but I think that's as much to do with the weather as anything else. And he's got general election year, so he's ruled out the fact that we're going to have a spring election. He's talking about an autumn election. He's playing the long game. He's got a budget coming up on March the 6th, which you will hope Jeremy Hunt can pull a couple of rabbits out the hat. He set himself up as the tax-cutting prime minister. And now he's got Rwanda round his neck again. He's lost two vice chairs this week. Resignation, the junior minister resigned as well. He's got his former minister and best mate, Robert Jenry, criticising him from the backbenches. And okay, he's got through that third reading in Parliament yesterday of the Rwanda bill, but it's got to go to the Lords. I think there's still trouble ahead for him as far as that particular policy is concerned. And then he was absolutely battered by Keir Starmer yesterday, because apparently the Home Office and the government have lost 4,200 refugees, asylum seekers, call them what you will, but they've disappeared into the ether. And he looked a bit silly, stood at the dispatch box, simply repeating this soundbite that is clearly going to be something the Tories focus on, back to square one with Labour. Well, I'll tell you what, Jim, I think I'd rather go back to square one than be where we are at this moment in time with an absolutely shambolic immigration policy.
Well, let me try and devil's advocate in a moment, but the 4,000 missing is all part of this, strong word to use, but fraudulent way in which they've removed the historic waiting list. And they've done it by either admitting large numbers of people and you've got to wonder whether they actually qualified to get refugee status. And then they've got these people who have just disappeared, but they've been able to write it off, and they say, well, we've dealt with the historic list. I mean, it's complete nonsense. Now, let me, and it ties in with the Trump thing in America. The United States and this country are facing illegal migration on a big scale. And it is something that does concern voters. So the question I would throw back to you is, it is this attempt to do something about it actually resonating with people? And albeit it's incredibly clunky, will he get credit for trying to do something? And then, just like Trump sort of says, oh, the lawyers are all getting at me, that Sunak can turn around and say, well, despite pressure from my right wing, we left in the bill the opportunity to make some appeals, and look how they're exploiting it. You know, I've got to go to the country, and I'm trying. I don't know. I mean, I've just put it back to you. It is a mess, and the numbers of people who are going to go to Rwanda compared to the problem are minuscule, and it's extremely expensive. But does he get any credit for trying to do something?
Well, I think he hangs himself on his own petard. And one of his answers to Keir Starmer's questions yesterday did exactly that. Because what has Keir Starmer been calling for? Keir Starmer has been saying, we've got to sit down, collaborate and have partnership agreements with our European neighbours. Sunak stands up yesterday and says, what a fantastic success our Albanian scheme is. Well, okay, it is, by the way. That is the most successful initiative that has taken place to reduce immigration numbers. And of course, we're having terrible trouble in terms of Albanian gangs coming over to the UK and elsewhere in Europe. How did we solve that? Sunak sat down with the Albanian Prime Minister, did the deal. What Starmer's saying, let's sit down with our neighbours from across Europe and come up with a strategy that suits everybody. And that's where Sunak, I think, in his argument, and the right argument in this particular case falls down. Now, are people stupid enough to fall for the soundbite and for the virtue signalling of Rwanda? I'm not sure they are, Jim, because I think, again, if you heard Jess Phillips' speech in the Commons last night, it was absolutely tremendous. It's now, I think she said, going to cost £169,000 per person. Maybe that was from within her constituency, just to get somebody on a flight to Rwanda. And at the moment, we haven't sent anybody over to Rwanda. And equally, we've taken Rwandans into this country. It's farcical. And then when you get the president of Rwanda saying, actually, guys, you can have your money back, and we don't think this is a great policy because we think it might break international law, then you do have to wonder whether this is the sort of, even from a political, a gesture politics perspective, the right sort of path to go down. So I would just say to you that I think Labour, if they can get their narrative and messaging right on this, can actually push back quite hard and say, no, we're not going to be soft on immigration. We're going to replicate what you've absolutely been able to do with the Albanians right across the European community.
Well, I don't know. I should know, I suppose. What was the Albanian deal? I don't understand why the Albanian government was so happy to take back these gangsters, because that's what they were. I don't understand how that worked. The problem with Labour's alternative, in my opinion, is, we have tried to have an arrangement with the French, for instance, because France is the main country that we need to cooperate with. And we've given them a lot of money, but it hasn't made any difference. And I think the French are taking the mickey, frankly. I think, as we've discussed before, basically the French just want to push them through. You know, there's no advantage to the French to collaborate with an incoming Labour government to keep more asylum seekers in their country. And that's where I think it falls down. I think it's an almost insoluble
problem.
But
I don't think, but then you've got to question why everybody ends up in France. So that's why Starmer's strategy of dealing with this as a European issue is absolutely the right one. You can't deal with this as an isolated country. You can't deal with this as the UK or as France or as Germany or as Italy. You've got to have a common policy set in train. And actually, if we spent as much trying to find out who these bloody gangsters are and sort the people traffickers out, rather than targeting the poor bloody people who are being trafficked. That, for me, is where we should be.
Do you not think that's going on?
No, well, clearly not, because we've been going on for 20 years. It's not a new problem, right? And so organised crime, it's not particularly sexy to say we're going to try and find out who the mafiosos are, because people go, okay. Whereas if you target those poor buggers who are coming over the channel, who are absolutely desperate, by the way, because why would you go on that journey? You know, this, and again, I'd say to you, Jim, this idea that it's going to be some sort of deterrent, that, you know, there's a one in a million chance that you might get put on a plane to Rwanda, especially when they're saying Rwanda's the best place on earth, by the way. That's the other thing. I'd be trying to get over here to say, oh, put me on a plane, please. Looks great, that plane. I just don't think it sells. And I think the more that people are talking about the issue, the less attractive, and I'm talking about sort of ordinary Joe and Joanne blogs in the street now, the less attractive the proposition becomes, because people aren't that thick. You've got how much to send how many people? And how many immigrants have we had into this country this year? 750,000. And we're talking about putting 400 people, 400 of them on a plane to Rwanda. 400. At the cost of £169,000 per elector, per taxpayer. I mean, come on. I just think that that is an argument that if Sunak wants to get into, he's going to lose. And the other problem he's got, sorry, I'll finish on that, is that it doesn't really matter what he says or where he goes with that policy. He is never going to be able to outright reform.
Well, that's it. Just to say, and I'm very interested to discuss the reform thing. That's a very important thing. I'm just not convinced that having Yvette Cooper in the Home Office is going to energise Interpol to find these gangs more than they are at the moment. I don't see the connection there. But moving on, because I think we're getting into a spiral of negativity, and I think that's right, actually, because I think it's a very intractable problem. But obviously, you're absolutely right. What's driving this is that Tice and Farage are looming up. You know, we've seen this playbook before. You know, Brexit was caused by the rise of UKIP and the Tories being terrified of what's coming up from the right, and it's happening again. And, you know, we talked about Ed Davey earlier. I mean, Reform are getting in the polls. They're up there with the Liberal Democrats. And, you know, there are these concerns, and some of the polls indicate if Reform are going to stand everywhere. This is what's driving this to some extent.
But Sunak falling into the same trap as Theresa May fell into, thinking that you can placate these buggers because, you know, these Spartans, in fact, five families they call them themselves now, aren't they? A mafia, I mean, Christ, a mafia. Lee Anderson is a godfather, can you imagine? I think it was Gavin Barwin said yesterday on social media, it's not like Goodfellas, it's more like Dumb and Dumber, these five mafioso families within the Conservative Party. But you know what Sunak seems to be doing with this Rwanda policy, which as Chancellor he thought was nonsensical. His Home Secretary has said it's batshit, crazy, and yet they're still trying to pursue this, and they're doing it to placate about 60 MPs within the Conservative Party. He's not trying to lead them away from what he knows is just virtue signalling. Well, it pisses me off, Jim. I think it's just, it's why politics in this country is so poor at the moment.
But don't you think that there is an element of the Red Wall in particular, who people who voted Conservative for the first time, who are available to go over to Reform because they put this immigration issue even above the economy? Don't you think there is a body of voters?
I don't think they do. I mean, I haven't seen any polling evidence that suggests that. But equally, and I've said this before on this podcast, there is a time when politicians have to lead and they have to start to have a serious and mature conversation with the electorate. And I've just finished a wonderful book, actually, about the 70s. I'll find out the author of the book. And it struck me how many comparisons there are between what we're going through now and what we were going through in the 70s, because that time, of course, we had Enoch Powell. Now, it would have been very easy for Edward Heath et al. To have fallen in to the Enoch Powell rhetoric because he was very popular at the time. And we had, by the way, the Ugandan crisis. You know, visibly, there were literally thousands of people getting off planes legally coming into our country. Massive uproar at the time, particularly in what you would describe as those Red Wall seats and in the Midlands. And Enoch Powell, you know, with due respect to Richard Tyson, Nigel Farage, a far brighter, far more charismatic politician than either of those pair. And he was face down. And the problem we have at this moment in time, Jim, is people who know better, who know these policies don't work, who know immigration isn't the problem that people are trying to make out.
There was a reaction.
Won't face them up.
There was a reaction to, if you like, the refusal of the mainstream policy. And I agree with you. He sacked Powell from the shadow cabinet in 1968 after the Rivers of Blood speech and continued to maintain that. But there was a bit of a reaction which led to the National Front rising. And which I remember covering and walking through Tameside.
But the National Front didn't take over the Tory party.
No.
Reform had taken over the Tory party. Yeah. That's my argument. No, I'm not suggesting that Powell didn't have a following, that he didn't have traction. But at least it was a debate that was taking place where you had politicians actually putting the case for immigration. And at this moment in time, and I will place this as Labour's door as well, you know, if those 700,000 immigrants, I was at an event on Tuesday in Wolverhampton, and we had the Vice Chancellor of the university telling us how important it was to have foreign students here. We know that we've got vacancies coming out of our ears in this country at the moment. We can't get the workforce. The reason immigration is still high is because
most of them... Do you have an upper limit for how many immigrants we should take into this country every year?
Yeah, I do. As many as we need.
Really? And you think Labour can go to the country on that?
No, of course they can't. And that's the problem, because nobody's making that case. But if you say to me at this moment in time, Brexit was supposed to sort this problem out, well, immigration has spiked significantly since Brexit. Now you're trying to tell me that putting 400 people on a plane to Rwanda is going to sort it out.
Well, I admire your frankness, and you know, there may be something in the argument, but it's brave, Mr. McKenna. It's brave to say that. And I think it would have a huge adverse reaction amongst people who rightly or wrongly perceive that this country's public services are under huge pressure already. And you've just said you have no upper limit to immigration into this country. And I think quite a lot of Labour politicians actually believe that. But I think that will have a huge reaction and will swell the swell the ranks of reform, I'm afraid.
Well, the pressure on public services, of course, got nothing to do with near 15 years of austerity and everything to do with 700,000 people, most of whom contribute hugely to our economy and, of course, to our universities. But listen, final point I'll make on this, and then we're going to go to a short break, is the thing that nobody is talking about at the moment, seriously, and I think they do need to if we are going to resolve this global problem, and it is a global problem. Italy, France, far greater challenges in this particular area than we have. The European Court of Human Rights and that legislation was written just after the war. Now, where I would concede to some of these nutters who get up and start chatting shite about immigration from the Tory backbenchers is that that needs to be reviewed. Any policy that was written in the last century, the middle of the last century, needs to be reviewed. And again, I think Starmer, particularly given the fact that Sunak keeps reminding people he's an expert on human rights law, could actually go to the country and say, I am going to force a conversation on that particular piece of law and legislation because it's outdated. And again, I think he'd get an awful lot of support from other European leaders. That's a mature conversation. But saying, I'm going to get 400 people and put them on a plane to Rwanda and that'll stop the boat. A load of bollocks, Jim. Should we finish there? The first part.
I think we need to move on. This has been a really good conversation, but it's one that you don't hear because nobody's prepared to be as honest as you are about what you believe. And this is the problem. You know, Labour is paralysed. In our conversation, we have laid out what is the huge problem for the Labour Party and being frank about this. You know, you could, as you say, in an idealistic world, you know, they're a socialist party, they're the left party, they believe in internationalism. There's a job to do in this country that we need hundreds of thousands of people to do those jobs, to care for our elderly, whatever it might be. And so we're, you know, we'll obviously have some border controls, but broadly speaking, let it balance itself out. And we'll take as many immigrants
as we can. Dragging me back into the conversation, James. I'd say as a conservative capitalist, I would say we've got to have our economy working as most effectively and efficiently as it can. And at this moment in time, because we've had no investment into our infrastructure, no investment into our skills, no investment into our education, we've got a massive gap in terms of our employment markets, and our universities without foreign students will be killed. And so as a capitalist conservative, I am saying immigration is absolutely necessary for the good of economic growth in our country. So it's not a socialist thing. It's not a fluffy thing. I'm not a socialist. I absolutely am not a socialist. I'm a social democrat. But immigration is for the good of our economy. And if you're a conservative, a genuine conservative, not one of these wankers who wants to wave a flag and pretend that all immigration is bad, then I'm sorry, you should be in the Reform Party or what used to be the National Front. James, we could go on all day with the immigration discussion. I'm sure we'll come back to this later in the year. We'll take a short break. And if the listeners can go and get themselves a cup of coffee and calm down,
and we'll be back in a moment.
If you like your politics, and obviously you do if you're listening to the Downtown Den podcast, then you will love being part of the Downtown in Business Network in 2024. We've already confirmed some fabulous political speakers for this year, including the mayors of West Yorkshire and Greater Manchester. That's Tracy Braben and Andy Byrne. And we've got shadow ministers coming along to our parliamentary reception later this month as well, including the shadow business secretary, Johnny Reynolds. And later in the year, we're hoping to confirm attendance at our events of the Common Sense Minister, Esther McVeigh, and the Minister for Education, Gillian Keegan. Lots more besides. So if you're not a member of Downtown in Business yet, why not? If you've made a New Year's resolution to grow your business, then not only do we do great political discussion and debate, but we have a wide-ranging network which allows your business to generate new leads, make new connections, and hopefully grow your business as well. So get in touch with us today. Visit our website, all the W's, downtowninbusiness.com. Look at the join section of that website, and that will tell you how you can get involved. If you are a member already, then I look forward to seeing you at an event in the very near future. Welcome back to the second part of our first Downtown Den Politics podcast of 2024. Delighted to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Jim Hancock. In the first part of the programme, we were talking about the immigration policy. We touched on the post office scandal as well. Jim, second part of the programme, want to talk about the Labour Party and some interesting polls that were produced this week.
Yes, I mean, we started off on Monday with the Daily Telegraph with an enormous headline talking about a Labour landslide of 120 seats. And that was followed up by a detailed study by two professors of politics called Rawlings and Thresher for the BBC, ITN and so on, which actually said for Labour to achieve a one-seat majority, they would need a 12% swing, which was 2 points ahead of what even Tony Blair got. So there we had a huge contrast between the polls. And I've done my blog on it this week for Downtown, so people can study the arguments in greater detail there. But my conclusion was to favour the Rawlings and Thresher analysis for a number of reasons. I think the Telegraph had done this poll to all in relation to the Rwanda thing, which we've already discussed on this podcast, to try and, you know, frighten the Prime Minister into making concessions and so on. And if you don't make these concessions, look what you're heading for. Because Lord
it
Frost
was predicting a Labour majority of 129, I think.
129, yeah. And this is, let's remind people, from a Tory majority in 2019 of 80. It's down to 58, by the way, now. We still talk about this 80-seat majority. With all the things that have gone on, they're down to 58. So I think that poll was a very politicised poll. Lord Frost did an editorial right next to it, and, you know, warning about Brexit and all these betrayals that the Tory right feel that Sunak has perpetrated. So I really dismiss that. And the other reason I dismiss it, and I'm a bit of an anorak on this, is that I chose this opportunity to look back at Labour's success or lack of it in the 100 years this week since the formation of the first Labour government in 1924. It was a hung parliament. The Tories were the largest party. But there's still a considerable Liberal presence, and the Liberals allowed Ramsay MacDonald to form the first, but short-lived, Labour government. And I then looked at the damning statistics over those 100 years. In only 33 years of those 100 years have Labour been in office, and very often with tiny majorities. Only in 1945, 1966, and then the Blair ones, 97, 01 and 05, have Labour won convincing majorities. So I think in terms of those polls, it looks to me as if we ought to concentrate on Labour's underperformance. And there's no reason, well, there is reason, because they're 20 points ahead in the polls. There's reasons for confidence, but you can see why Labour's spokespeople are always saying to us, oh, we're not over the line yet. And I think they're wise to be cautious, even with all the deficiencies of this Conservative government. Mm.
Ramsay MacDonald. Traitors to the working class.
Well, yes, I mean, we can discuss that if you want.
The history,
it's a very interesting history, actually. But
only our heritage listeners will be interested in that journey. Nobody's interested in heritage fans anymore. But we'll talk about that on another podcast.
Yes, indeed.
Mostly in relation to football, the Premier League, and what a fucking shambles Richard Masters and his people are. Anyway, listen, Jim, Labour Party. So you say, you know, both in the initial conversation we had over immigration and now in terms of these poll numbers and the history of Labour's performance in general elections, they've got to be careful. Keir Starmer and his team have got to be careful. But then on other occasions, I've heard you and others say, Starmer's got to be bolder. Why aren't they going out there and putting the case for the country for change? So what is it?
Well, I mean, in the first part of our programme, you suggested a bold analysis, you know, a bold strategy for Labour on the question of immigration.
Caveat that. I didn't suggest that Keir Starmer should be going out to the electorate saying we should have no upper limits on immigration. I think he has a narrative where he can say to the British electorate, the Albanian model is the one that I will follow. But if you talk about boldness, let's be frank. I have to be frank. You're not talking about immigration. You're talking about tax cuts. Tax rises. You're talking about investments into public services. You're talking about what we can do in terms of our school, our schools, our health service. So you're now saying, well, if Labour goes out and starts promising all sorts of stuff, well, chances are they'll lose again.
Well, no, I'm not really. I'm probably saying that this Ming Vase strategy, and I only heard Rachel Reeves yesterday from Davos reiterating this, we are not going to promise anything that we haven't costed. She's absolutely determined to stick to this because on occasions in the past, 1992 being one of them, Labour have blown it by allowing the Tories to say, look, tax bombshell.
Oh, yeah. As Neil Kinnock said in Sheffield.
But also there was the John Smith tax proposals.
The tax bombshell. The Tories had that wonderful campaign. Yeah. Labour's tax bombshell, it costs every family in the UK £3,000
a year. And they played that card time and again. Yeah, and this is what's
a very effective campaign.
Has led to these underperformance by Labour. So you can see what's going on here. But I do accept your criticism that I'm slightly duplicitous, because in this ultra-cautious approach, which I understand for the reasons that I've mentioned, I do get a bit frustrated, because the danger is, on the other side, it becomes totally uninspirational. And I think that's...
There's no enthusiasm for Labour, is there? I think what you see from the polling is people accepting there is a need for a change, but not being particularly enthused or motivated by what that change might be.
Yes. But also, to be fair to Rachel Reeves, the enormity of the problems that she will face. I mean, I think I said on a previous podcast, within 6 months, she's going to be the most unpopular politician in this country, because she'll come in and the huge challenges that the Tories will have left them are not going to make them very popular. It's, you know, and you can already hear the narrative, as I've said in my blog, another short-term Labour government, and then the Tories come back or whatever, because the problems are absolutely immense. And that's another reason why they're having to be cautious about it.
Mm. Now, I accept all of those things that you've said. My view is that there will be a Labour government, but I don't think it's going to be a landslide majority. And for the things that you've laid, boundary changes make it more difficult for them. So the Rawlins and Thrasher poll, or their analysis, was taking account of those boundary changes, which I think give the Tories, in a good year for them, another thought, 30 or 40 seats.
It's much less than that. It's about plus seven. But those are actual seats. But, you know, the boundary changes do, you know,
Labour, they're all helpful to Labour.
The Labour have had, especially in Wales, had tiny little seats. Yeah. You know, these boundary changes is to make sure that all the constituencies are around 75,000 people. Yeah. And Labour had a lot of small seats, so technically.
On the other side of that same coin, Labour 2 years ago wouldn't have been expecting to win any seats in Scotland. And so that's going to help them significantly, isn't it? And so I think that 12.7% swing that is being suggested, you could actually say, well, yeah, but a good performance in Scotland, and Starmer is on his way to victory.
And of course, the other thing is that smaller swings than that remove the Conservative majority. And then the next one is that Labour is the largest party and things like that. You know, so, you know, I mean, there'd be a very powerful argument if the Conservatives lose their majority that they should have any legitimacy to form any sort of government, because they will have lost the confidence of the people. But, you know, I mean, and the Conservative, who would they do a deal with?
Yeah.
Well, don't get me started UK on the deep. Well, Bill, that's something Bill, else we ought to discuss on a future podcast,
few
by the way.
At them. So let's go to the sort of potential Tory attack and the way in which Sunak's going to try and cling on to power. And immigration is clearly going to be one. The economy seems to be front and centre. But it's mixed news, Jim. And, you know, we're going to talk about the American presidential election in a moment. The American economy headline is doing really well, but people aren't feeling it in their pockets. And again, you know, lessons to be learned from history. Starmer should be taking a line from Ronald Reagan in the 81 presidential campaign, when he said to the voters, who was behind in the polls to Jimmy Carter, not 20 points earned, well, you know, when you go to the polls next week, you need to remember whether you're better off in your pocket now or whether you were before this fella landed. Sunak's sort of putting an awful lot riding on this economic improvement. I'm not sure people are going to buy it.
No, well, you're entitled to your view. I just think, in terms of my slight obsession with how the Labour lead could be diminished. I mean, I think there's always
going to be 20 points.
No, it
by
isn't.
The time
I mean, there's always a bit
election
of attrition on the lead by
for
another
sure
party. When people actually focus on what they're going to do, it tends to come down. Now, I'm just putting to you that if, generally speaking, the inflation and other economic indicators through to the autumn, because it looks as if we are going to the autumn now, are generally a better news story. It slightly softens that thing. But you're probably right that they'll say, well, maybe a bit, but I'm still suffering in my pocket.
Inflation's stubborn, though, isn't it? And isn't it funny? It went up a bit yesterday, and I heard a government minister saying, well, yeah, but that's nothing to do with us. And of course, when it goes down, the government says, well, this is because the plan's working. But inflation's stubborn. I think the biggest problem they have is interest rate, actually, because even if they start to come down a little over the next few months, and I think they will, I think the Bank of England have sort of signaled that they will try to reduce interest rates over the coming months in 2024. The difficulty is that an awful lot of people are tied into mortgages now, which have basically given them a better interest rate than they would have had if they just stayed on a tracker, but are still higher than they were previous to the Liz Truss car crash. And I think that, you know, if you're looking at a typical profile of a Tory voter, and I don't like pigeonholing people, but, you know, an awful lot of people with mortgages would be seen as a target voter for the Tory party. So I think that's another problem.
And it resurrects the Truss shambles again,
yeah,
which does work very much.
Which Labour will have to focus
on. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, when you look at the opinion poll, how the Tories lost, you know, from this triumph of 2019, the two huge dips were Partygate and the Truss period. That's when the opinion polls went down and then down again massively. That made the difference.
Is there some traction for the Tory parties with this lefty lawyer attack? Because again, Sunak at Prime Minister's questions, he was admonished by the Speaker, actually. I don't know if you saw that. He had a prop from a paper that Keir Starmer had written in 1903 about human rights. And he was saying, you wrote this, you know. Is that going to be a thing that sticks against
sort of
Starmer?
That's the sort of Trumpian thing, you know.
Sunak's accusing Starmer of doing his job, basically, isn't he? But will it stick? I mean, that is true. That is, Starmer was doing his job. He was a lawyer, and lawyers take an oath. And I know there's some Tory MPs who don't think oaths matter these days. Boris Johnson was one of them. But, you know, somebody like Starmer, I would suggest, does. And he was having to defend people that perhaps he wasn't necessarily comfortable with defending. So is that something that Labour are going to be able to explain away, or will
sure
it stick?
I'm not sure, because some of these podcasts is we could talk all day about things, because you're opening up another thing which also applies in the United States, which is a slight diminishing of people's respect for the rule of law. You know, there's a trend here and in the United States that the political objective overwhelms the lawyers thing, and it's quite complicated, and it even refers back to the post office thing. I understand why the government are going to give a blanket pardon to everybody, but it does breach that business, you know, that, and it's like Rwanda, we say, Parliament says Rwanda is safe, we say these postmasters are innocent. It is overriding the courts, and we had the huge controversy about the proroguing of Parliament a few years ago. So there is a growing and interesting issue about that, and I would hope that the electorate would favour a party that would stick by the law, because
doesn't it sound incredible, though, that you sort of said to me in the first part of the podcast, well, the socialist view of this should blah, 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 blah. Again, I would go back to, as a traditional conservative, I would expect you to say, first and foremost, we uphold the law.
Yes.
And yet, it's the Conservative Party over the past 10 years, perhaps, maybe not quite that long, that have really damaged the reputation of the law.
I'll take you right back to Tudor times just to finish this off. There was a wonderful quote in Robert Bolt's Man for All Seasons where Thomas More is talking to Richard Rich, and Richard Rich says, yes, I would tear down all the laws in order to achieve it. Oh, would you, Sir Richard? And all those laws being down, I wouldn't like to be you in the winds that would then howl. And that, to some extent, is something we need to think about.
What we say in Liverpool, in comparison to that phrase, be careful what you wish for.
Exactly. Yeah. Same thing.
So let's just turn it back, flip it. If you're Labour, worry your attack lines. And I'll tell you my first one. Vote for Sunak. Get who? Because Rishi Sunak would not survive a five-year parliament as Prime Minister. Who's he going to be replaced with? And Labour can say, these people don't care whether you elect them or not, because they've already done in Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Sunak's next. We know the parliamentary party are not 100% behind him. His membership absolutely don't want him. So Sunak, at the first sign of trouble in a new parliament, if he was to be re-elected as prime minister, would not survive. I would be really pushing that, Jim, because I think you then start to get into that. Well, who would they put in charge? I think that's a good attack line. Well,
that's a very interesting issue about the future of the Conservative Party. And again, the parallels with the Republican Party in the United States, very germane. You know, you've had the Republican Party in America, which broadly speaking, there was a consensus about its role in the world. And supporting NATO and abiding by the law, that's changed considerably. It's now a Trumpian party. What you're suggesting is that there are people who are poised to take over this centre-right party that we've known, sort of more or less one nation conservative. Mrs. Thatcher strained that to some extent, but she still observed a lot of the boundaries. And you're suggesting that there are people poised to lead the Conservative Party in a radical right direction, presumably to see off reform. But I just wonder if Sunak was able to win the election, whether that wouldn't enhance the centrists and the left of centre in the Tory party to fend off the right. And it was interesting. No.
Vote Sunak, get Anderson. That's a good message for Labour. Another good poster that Labour could use. One of the people that were prosecuted and jailed for the post office scandal alongside Michelle Moan and her husband. One rule for them. That'd be another strong poster, I would suggest, particularly at this moment in time. I've got loads of attack lines that the Labour Party could use against the Conservatives, but listen.
Have you had the call yet?
I haven't. But I do talk to one or two Labour politicians, as you know, Jim, so some of these messages might get through. It's going to be an interesting time. Let me get to the end of the conversation about our sort of domestic election by asking you when you do think the election is going to be called. I think our producer, Chris, is here. Chris, have you got your phone with you? Tell me what Thursday in November is nearest to the 21st.
21st of November.
Might be the 21st of November, might be the Thursday. 21st is a Thursday. I think it might be the Liverpool Awards. Wouldn't that be good? Imagine the night we'd have if we had the Liverpool Awards and the general election going on at the same time.
Can we have a screen in the dining room?
I'll have to have a red phone. Obviously, Keir will be phoning me up every 5 minutes asking me what's going
on. Lord McKenna.
But I am predicting, Jim, the 21st of November for the general election.
Right.
What do you
think? This is interesting because you're presumably doing this that the Conservative conference would be a launch platform. Yes. I mean, in 1974, the conferences were cancelled so that they could have a general election. I mean, there is a small issue. I don't think this would be overwhelming. I mean, the party conferences now are big money makers for the political parties. So I think they wouldn't be disposed to cancel it. So that I can see why you're pushing it into November. I just think it's such a grim month and so on. And traditionally, October's been the last month where you could hold an election. Obviously, we have one in December. So I probably go along with you. I do think, you know, I mean, there's still this tiny nagging thing in my mind. I'll just put it out there. You know, the Rwanda thing gets stuck in the Lords and he gets exasperated and he sees some sort of thing and says, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go. Going to go in the spring. I just leave that as a tiny possibility.
Yeah, I think this,
shock everybody and go for it.
Yeah, maybe. But
generally speaking, the autumn. And so if it is the autumn,
hasn't he? I mean,
he left himself a tiny option. He said, my working assumption, I think he said, well, you know, but the working assumptions can change. But no, I think he does need the longer pull. And you make a powerful case that they wouldn't cancel the party conferences. So that does mean you're heading into November. Yeah, well, yeah, probably right.
Yeah. And if it was to put you on the spot and say who you think's going to win? Now, sitting here today, things change. Next week, we may have a different view.
I think probably Starmer will win a very small overall majority. But it's not certain. It could just be a shade off that. But he would have plenty, you know, this is what I said when we were talking earlier about the swings needed. That as soon as the Conservatives lose their overall majority, they're in very, very difficult territory. They have no partners. I can't imagine the DUP, after all this performance, could prop them up again. So they have no partners. So they need an overall majority. Whereas Labour would be able to say to the other parties, almost without coalition or any sort of promises, the Scottish Nationalists going to bring down a minority Labour government immediately? None of the Liberals, Labour, SNP and the odds and sods are going to bring down it. So anything would allow Starmer to form a government. Now, of course, you will want to talk about the Corbyn left that would have power within that situation to make trouble. But, I mean, so I think... A probably an overall Labour majority, possibly a minority Labour government, but a Labour government, Starmer, no deals. He doesn't have to do deals. That's my prediction.
Mm. I don't think the other parties would necessarily want to do a deal, given the experience the Lib Dems had after the last coalition wiped out, still damaged reputation on the back of that. And again, I'm not wanting to recommend people go and listen to lots of other podcasts, because of course they should get all their information from here. But I heard a fascinating conversation on Political Currency, which is the podcast between George Osborne and Ed Balls. And they had Daddy Alexander on as a guest, talking about the negotiations over that sort of 4 days as to how the Conservatives persuaded, and I don't think they had to do much persuading actually, the Lib Dems to fall in behind them and form that coalition. And again, really interesting to hear the hindsight from both Danny Alexander and Ed Balls, actually, because he was on the other side of the negotiation. And isn't it strange? One of the things that the Lib Dems demanded, you will probably remember this, was that Gordon Brown stood down as Prime Minister, which of course he did, but it still wasn't enough to deliver the Lib Dems to form a coalition with the Labour Party. We could be into that sort of hung parliament territory again. And if there was a betting person at this moment in time, as we stand, given all the things that we've said about boundary changes, about the huge swing that Labour needs, and about the fact that, you know, rightly or wrongly, Labour are not going to be necessarily bold and therefore not going to be giving people a hugely enthusiastic product to vote for, then chances are, yeah, I think you're probably right, hung parliament. Not so, I don't think, in America, though. And so if you'd have told me 4 years ago that Donald Trump was going to be back running for president, never mind favourite to win the White House, I'd have probably put you in a box with Lee Anderson and sent you over to Rwanda. But he's just won the Iowa caucus, which for listeners who don't necessarily follow American politics, this is where parties select their candidate. And usually these caucuses, relatively close run things in that somebody might win by 10 percentage points or so. Trump won over 50% of the vote there. They're on to New Hampshire. Again, little chance of anybody coming near him. It seems as though he's just a steamroller through to the Republican nomination. And then we have, you know, who Trump describes as Sleepy Joe, not really being able to lay a glove on him. So, Jim, are you as sort of depressed as I am about what's going to happen in the States?
Yes, more than depressed, very worried. I mean, what's totally extraordinary is that Trump is turning up at all these court appearances. He doesn't have to be there, but he's going there because every time he turns up in court and comes out and says, there's another judge having a go at me, I'm being persecuted, not prosecuted, his poll ratings go up. I mean, it is utterly perverse that he didn't really campaign in Iowa, whereas Ron DeSantis spent millions of pounds to no avail. So he's, not for the first time, he's breaking all the political rules that you and I have grown up with. So my conclusion is that he is definitely the Republican nominee. And then we come to the Biden problem, which grows by the day. I mean, his age is overwhelmingly the issue, I'm afraid, because actually the economy and the investment in infrastructure, somehow he doesn't seem to be able to make the case, he's not resonating with the American people. And the Democratic Party are paralyzed. I don't know, out of respect for his political career, or because ageism is not a comfortable issue to raise, but nobody seems to dare to say they're heading for disaster with this, because there's only 5 years, but Trump's 77, but Biden patently looks elderly, whereas Trump doesn't. And you know, this is a factor.
Some of us age well, Jim. What can I say?
There was this extraordinary, extraordinary unfortunate business where the American defense secretary went in for a prostate operation without telling him. And the defense secretary is a man who's virtually got his finger on the nuclear, you know, at the behest of the, you know, the president rings, you know, and the nuclear button is pushed.
Made by the
Milkweek. So you wonder whether, I mean, it's only a, in the great scheme of things, a small thing, but, you know, it's just bad news stories for Biden. But they're now, some distinguished commentators I've listened to, they've missed the boat. You know, replacing at this stage is quite tricky. Yeah. Of course, you know, I don't want to be morbid about it. they might be forced to. And there are Gretchen Whitmer, I believe, and the governor of Wisconsin and the governor of California. And polls indicate that either of those two would beat Trump. So we're in this extraordinary position at the moment.
Yeah, the Democrats seem to have almost sleptwalked into this situation. But to sort of give them some sympathy and credit, you know, if you look at the midterm elections in America only 12 months ago, they did far better than was anticipated. And Biden was actually on a bit of a crest of a wave. And ironically, as you sort of indicated, the court cases have helped Trump. They give him profile. They've allowed him to play into this, you know, nonsensical conversation, I'm being persecuted. But again, I've spoken to some Democrats in the States who said to me, the worst thing that happens here is that we've started to prosecute him for trivial matters. You know, we haven't focused on the big thing of him trying to overturn an election, all that. So, you know, we're going after him for all sorts of stuff that, in the big scheme of things, the phrase you use, isn't that important. And therefore, it does start to look like a bit of a witch hunt. It's like they're trying to get this guy for anything. And even the Americans who are not necessarily turned on to Trump, people who perhaps float in voters or agnostic, are saying, we don't like this. It smells a bit. And of course, unlike our system, and, you know, America's always held up as the greatest democracy on earth, load of bollocks. You know, their court system actually is well open to corruption, isn't it? Because all the bloody people are appointed by politicians. It's incredible. Well, yes, and they're all Democrats or Republicans.
And another little anarchy thing of mine is that the districts, the polling districts, are all decided politically. You know, we've been talking about boundary changes in this country for the election, which has all been done by an independent commission. Whereas in America, you look at the boundaries of the electoral divisions and they're all done in order to favour the party that happens to be in office at that time. So there is that challenge. But I mean, you know, probably haven't got time to talk about it today, but a Trump victory, his renunciation of NATO, his somebody said he would say to the Russians, keep what you've got in Ukraine, but don't be naughty boys anymore. All that sort of stuff poses huge problems for the West. Mm.
And it is going to be interesting to see how our politicians domestically react to a Trump victory, because if I'm right, the presidential election will have taken place. We'll know the result. And therefore, Prime Minister Sunak, Prime Minister Starmer, Prime Minister Sunak, how's that investment of X billions of pounds into Ukraine looking this week as Donald Trump gets set to go back into the White House?
And yes.
It's Mr. Starmer. What does David Lammy now think about Donald Trump? Because 4 years ago, he was on a march protesting that he was coming to the country for a state visit.
Yes, that was the only thing I should have added when you were talking about the date of the election. It has happened before, 1964 and I think 1992. There is a feeling that it's not desirable that they be running at the same time. That might push it back from your November thing and cancel the party conferences and have it earlier. I should have said that. It's, you know, I mean, the crossover is probably, we mustn't exaggerate it, but it's an interesting...
And by the way, the United States don't give a shit about what's going on in the UK. You know, this bollocks about special relationships and all that sort of nonsense. It's for the birds.
Well, we seem to be at the end of the queue for that trade deal that we were going to get after Brexit.
Yeah, think about another 124 years, you know. Like, come back then and see, and I'll let you know whether Brexit's working or not. Jim, we can't get into Brexit as well. We've spoken about a whole range of things already. And we've come to the end of our first 2024 Downtown Den podcast. Been a pleasure to speak to you as always. Let me just remind you that we are going to start to do some Q&A. So if you've got questions to put to Jim or myself, then please email chris.wilcox@downtowninbusiness.com, and Chris will put the questions to us and we'll pick the best ones out and try our best to answer them. Doesn't necessarily have to be about what's happening at this moment in time. As you will know, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, Jim has got an encyclopedic memory of history. He was born in 1807 and he's followed politics from an early, early age. So anything that you want to ask historically or indeed about modern politics, please do let us know. Next week, I'm going to try, if we've got time, to take a look ahead to those mayoral elections that I mentioned in the introduction. Of course, Downtown and Business operates right across the country and deals with Andy Burnham, his office, Steve Rotherham in Liverpool City Region, Andy Street in the West Midlands, and others. Tracy Braben, who's going to be one of the speakers at our forthcoming property conference in February. She's the West Yorkshire Mayor, of course. So we'll be looking ahead to those elections, and who knows what this week is going to throw up. Maybe 30p Lee will decide to take his tent over to Reform. Maybe Nigel Farage will announce a comeback to be leader of that particular party. Or maybe Rishi Sunak will ask Farage to come back into the Conservative Party and be Foreign Secretary. Who knows? We live in strange times. See you next week.